Well, we're going to finish up kind of the study of the book of Exodus tonight with geography, Bible geography. According to the timeline, I'm supposed to be further along in the books of Joshua, Judges, and Ruth, but I will probably not deal with Numbers and Deuteronomy a whole lot. And the reason will be because of the geography is really established in the same place in the book of Exodus. So, like I said, this is not particularly a systematic study through the Bible. It is a study of Bible geography through the Bible. So I'm trying to make that enjoyable. I appreciate the comments that I've received since we started the class, and I do hope that it is edifying. Sunday morning, we had talked about the location of Moses, where he was hidden in the bulrushes or the reeds along the Nile River, and so that will be where we left off here. Exodus chapter 2, of course, talks about that. It's a very tender story of a mother who is protecting her child from the Pharaoh. And, of course, with Moses hidden, Pharaoh's family finds Moses and will raise him, will adopt him. And he is raised in the court of Pharaoh, highly educated. Stephen refers to this in Acts chapter 7, how he did not lack any education. A very sophisticated individual Moses will become. And it's very interesting how the Bible will talk about Moses being one who spoke face to face with God. He was indeed the one that was given the first written revelation, except maybe the book of Job. Moses is the one who receives the first written revelation directly from God, and thus the first five books of your Bible, known as the Torah or the Pentateuch, and then called, anybody know what it's called? The first five books of the Bible, often throughout the entire Bible? The Law of, isn't that interesting? God didn't call it the Law of God. It's called that, on occasion, it's called the Law of Moses, though. Moses was the one who would lead Israel. We took some pictures here of the reeds and various things to this day that are still being farmed and harvested. And one of the things we pointed out was that along the Nile River you have that material, that fibrous material, and papyrus, or however you want to say that, was developed. And that becomes the first paper. Today we get most of our paper from what? Trees, wood pulp. And in much of the country that has larger trees, pine trees especially, they'll take those trees and turn it into pulpwood, and they'll make paper. And so I'm from back in Arkansas. Logging and timberlands is a very big deal, and paper is still a big thing. So I'm just kind of pointing out some things, how things develop. Remember, the Egyptians were known for writing. What kind of a writing? Anybody remember what that writing is called? Hieroglyphics. That's right. And most of that, a lot of that was done on walls, or they carved it into stone, and they left their mark. But over time, the papyrus would come from a lot of that from the Nile River because of the abundance of that material. And that's, again, where Moses was hidden, in the bulrush or in the reeds of the Nile. Now, I'm fast-tracking a little bit here. I was supposed to change that passage, I think. I'm wrong on that again. Maybe I'm not. But in Exodus chapter 2, Moses will flee. Now, I'm right on this. You remember Moses will flee from Pharaoh because of what reason? What did Moses do that caused him to flee to Midian? That's right. And anybody know why he murdered that Egyptian? Yeah, who nursed Moses while he was in Pharaoh's court? Isn't that very, again, interesting from the standpoint that he was educated by Pharaoh, by the Egyptians, the most sophisticated nation of the day, master builders. And not only was he educated under Pharaoh's court, the highest education of the land, he likely knew the language very well. Indeed, he did. Anybody know where his name comes from, the origins of the name Moses? It's Egyptian. Yeah. It's got kind of an Egyptian type of background to it. And he was no doubt, that's where he gets his name. That's where he gets a lot of his influence and so forth. But he was nursed by his mother. So his mother obviously taught him the ways of the Hebrews, the ways of the Israelites. You remember what tribe Moses was from? He was a Levite. And which of the tribes then is the priestly tribe? The Levitical priesthood that will develop under Moses, and who will become the first high priest under the organized law of Moses? His brother, Aaron. Now, this is just kind of a thought, but who under the law of Moses was really responsible for preaching or teaching, exposing the law to the people of God? Again, it would have been not only the household, not only the fathers. Deuteronomy 6 makes it very clear that fathers were to teach their children the law. But as far as public exposure was concerned, the public exposure and teaching was really primarily to be taught through the tribe of Levi, or the Levitical tribe, the priestly tribe. And so Moses, of course, being a Levite, receives the revelation of God. And coincidental? You know, I don't know the answer to that. I would say that God certainly had his foresight set on Moses, and that would happen. So when he flees to Midian. It's kind of an interesting journey. The pathway, I'm not sure how he gets there, but I'd like you to take a look at that map and think about it as we look and consider the land of Egypt here. I want to show you something on Egypt that today is still kind of known. When we look at a map, we think of up being up, right? And that would be down, right? I mean, that's just normal. Perpendicular line, that's going up and that's going down. Well, that's called Lower Egypt. And this down here is called, say it, Rick. Yeah, lower and higher. Well, again, remember the mass population of Egypt is centered along the river. All your cities and most of your dwellings, Ethiopia's on down here, and so on. But in this lower area, what's called the lower, do you know why it's called Lower Egypt? Yes, sir. No, not necessarily, but that's a good idea, good thought. Which way does the Nile flow? Goes that way. Goes up into the Mediterranean. So, they call this Lower Egypt because of the Nile River's flow. Flows down or up. How are we going to look at that? But it's Lower Egypt at the end of the Nile River. Okay? And this, of course, is very fertile. This is where, again, likely Moses and the Ramses II was located. Some say that this city of Ramses up here was actually built by the Israelites. We're not sure about that, under slave labor. It appears that a lot of these cities were built by slaves. Whether it was the Israelites or not, we're not sure about that. The Bible does talk about this a little bit, but some people say names have changed. And so that's why I don't pin down a lot of this. But we do know that the Israelites were given this land in this area, and that's eventually where they're located. So Moses' family, Moses' people would have been somewhere around here. The Israelites, where Moses was found. You know, I don't know the answer to all that. I don't know how they differentiate all these little legs and, you know, offshoots of the actual main body of the River Nile. It's a lot of what we don't always understand, just like this. I'm jumping ahead of myself. I realize this. But when we look at these bodies of water right here, what is that body of water called right there? The Gulf of, and this is the Gulf of Aquaba. But when the Bible talks about the children of Israel fleeing Egypt and escaping from the Pharaoh and his army, what does it say they cross? The Red Sea. Well, this was likely referred to, and this whole body is connected to the Red Sea. So there's a lot of speculation on that still. Exactly where did the Israelites cross the Red Sea? So don't look at that as a contradiction. It's not a contradiction. It's still the same body of water. And don't allow a skeptic to confuse you. But here's another interesting point to consider. As we consider Moses' flight to Midian, this is just another map. We'll find Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai right here. Again, Midian right here. You can kind of look right here and get an idea how much space is involved here, 50 miles. So, I mean, you know, 50 miles, 100 miles, 150 miles, 200 miles, 250 miles or so. I don't know how long exactly if you took the route that Moses took to get down to Midian, but if I'm measuring about approximately, I'm thinking 250 miles. If you go as a crow flies, it changes, but I don't think that he was drifting across the bodies of water, but I don't know the answer to that. But what I do find interesting is this. When Moses flees to Midian, remember, who are the Midianites? Jethro, his former or future father-in-law, a Midianite, a priest, patriarchal priest. But who are the Midianites? Who are they descendants of? Remember, Abraham marries Keturah, and of that relationship, he has several children, and one of them is named Midian. The Midianites are descendants of Abraham. So, there is a familial connection with a lot of these people because of Abraham. And that's something to think about when you consider the relationship that he ends up having with Jethro, who grants him a wife, Zipporah, by whom he has his children. And the speculation there is that Zipporah is then a Midianite, not really speculative, but she's not an Israelite, okay? But she becomes, again, if you will, engrafted or converted, or however I'm thinking of that, to the Israelites. So, again, remember which one of the sons, or remember the issue of circumcision on the journey out of Egypt? And Zipporah gets pretty mad at Moses, it seems, gets kind of aggravated, and it's a contentious issue over the law or over the principle going back to Genesis 17 that all of Abraham's descendants were supposed to be circumcised. Now, let me again throw something else at you. If all of Abraham's descendants were supposed to be circumcised, then who does that include? It includes the Midianites. It includes not only the Midianites, it includes the Ishmaelites, it includes the Edomites, right? I'm echoing. Genesis 17 is a promise of something before or after the law of Moses is revealed. In history, it's before. That's exactly right. Do you know archaeologically today, when they excavate ancient tombs, and find, say, mummies and so forth, or bodies. Do you know one of the, if it's a male, do you know one of the first things they look for? They look to see if there's any resemblance of some, is this a circumcised male? Why do they do that? Why do archaeologists, secular archaeologists, do that? Time frame, but to identify influence, nationality. And isn't that interesting? Because who does that go back to? And the story of that is in the Bible. So they look back to see if they're Semitic people. Sometimes I think that's what they refer to it as. So again, just something to think about. Another thing too to realize, when Moses flees to Midian, and he's over here, and he eventually is told to come back, where does he have to lead the children of Israel back through to get up here to the promised land? I think I lost my, no I didn't. Where is the route that the promised land is taking? You see what I'm saying? Isn't this where the Israelites would be basically for about 40 years, wandering around? Well, remember something. Moses' life is broken down into 40-year increments. First 40 years of his life he spends over here. Gets in trouble in Exodus chapter 2 because he defends the children of God. He can't take it any longer. He sees the abuse. He kills a man. He flees over here to Midian. He is a shepherd of his father-in-law's animals. And for 40 years, who knows what he experiences all over this. Maybe he's over here. And guess where he will spend another 40 years before he dies? Do you think he's pretty familiar with that country? He was real familiar with that country. Now, that's some of the things you never think about maybe when you read your Bible, but when you study Bible geography, it might dawn on you. And that's what dawned on me as I went back through this. I thought, you know, old Moses, he was pretty good. He knew the land. He no doubt knew. And you spend 40 years in a time, in a location, and you're going to learn some things, aren't you? Especially being a shepherd. So some things to think about here. Here again are some maps to prepare you for the Exodus, the overall Exodus, when he'll have to come back. Again, these are some proposed routes of Moses and the Israelites. I'm not going to go into details, but I'm wanting to show you just sometimes various scholarship will differ on location. This map right here actually shows a crossing right here. It's speculative. It puts Elam right here. Well, I'm going to show you some other things over here where I believe it's maybe over here. But again, things sometimes change when you talk about this. I'm trying to point out principles, though. That's why I really don't want to get bogged down on saying this is that and so forth, because this, after all, is a Bible geography class that needs to be principally studied. Let's talk about Moses and the burning bush, okay? In Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 and following. Now, notice again here, he's still over here at Midian, somewhere around this area, but notice here where it says he's located. Verses 1 and 2, Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. Now, that's Mount Sinai. That's the same mountain as Sinai, same name. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush, and he looked and beheld the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. Now look at Acts chapter 7 just to point out the sermon of Stephen. I've alluded to it. Let's just go ahead and take a look at Acts 7. And remember, Stephen, inspired by God, preaches this. Verse 22, look at verses 20, Acts 7, verse 20 and following, just to remember the New Testament text referring to Moses. Stephen preaching this, in which time Moses was born and was exceeding fair and nourished up in his father's house 3 months. And when he was cast out, Pharaoh's daughter took him up and nourished him for her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and was mighty in words and deeds. And when he was full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed, and smote the Egyptian. For he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them, but they understood not. The next day he showed himself unto them as they strove and would have set them at one again, saying, Sirs, ye are brethren, why do ye wrong one to another? But he that did his neighbor wrong thrust him away, saying, Who made thee a ruler and a judge over us? Interesting question. Wilt thou kill me as thou didst the Egyptian yesterday? Then Moses fled at the saying, and was a stranger in the land of Midian, where he begot 2 sons. And when 40 years were expired, there appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai an angel of the Lord in a flame of fire in a bush. And when Moses saw it, he wondered at the sight. And as he drew near to behold it, the voice of the Lord came unto him, saying, I am the God of thy fathers, the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses trembled and durst not behold. Then said the Lord to him, put off thy shoes from thy feet, for the place where thou standest is holy ground. And he goes on and he talks about there the rest of that story. Well, let's talk about this particular location here. Again, Moses has been gone for 40 years, and now he is being, for whatever reason, he's over here with his father-in-law's animals, his flock, sheep of animals, shepherding his animals. And it tells us that he's at the base or in the valley around Mount Horeb, shepherding these sheep. Now, remember, this again is the route that the Israelites will take on the way out of Egypt fleeing from the Egyptians, protected by a cloud of fire by night and a pillar of cloud by day. You know, I don't know if you stopped to think about this, but when God brought them out of Egypt, why didn't he just take them on up in there? Why go all the way down and? Some of that, maybe, yeah, sure. It's not a true or false question, or you know, there's no doubt lots of reasons. He's preparing them. What does he do for 40 years? Yeah, a lot of them, but he ends up spending about 40 years wandering around over here in a circle. Won't let them go in. He's preparing them. He's weeding them out. That's kind of like when we go on vacation, you know. I see this little root over here. It says that's where Billy the Kid was killed. And I think, well, you know, we're in New Mexico. Let's just run on down there to Fort Sumter or whatever that's called. Next thing you know, I'm 40 miles off the beaten path because it's not right there. It's way out there in the middle of nowhere. And we're like, why'd you do that? That's right. Yeah, that's right. There was some time to spy out the land. Again, I want everybody to pay attention to that. When they come out of Egypt, they don't go bloop, right up to the promised land. No, there's a lot of fighting that's got to take place. God gives them the land and says, it's your land. The first victory when they get over to the promised land is what city? Jericho. Ai is the next one. And they don't get Ai immediately because of their faith. But the first city is Jericho, and those people are trembling because they've heard about this massive amount of people that's left Egypt and been wandering around for 40 years, and they've heard about all those plagues, and that's what the harlot says. We've heard about you. What had you heard? We heard about those plagues. We heard about what your God did to those Egyptians. We're scared of you. And God says, I'm giving you this land, but you're going to have to go take it. So a lot of things have to happen. So you might look at this as 40 years of preparing the children of Israel to take the land. And then even then, through Joshua, they do a pretty good job, but then we get to the book of Judges, what happens? They don't take them all. They leave a lot of people. And who is it, just fast forwarding again, who is it that eventually eradicates or gets all the Philistines and everybody out that's not supposed to be in there like they're practicing their idolatry? Remember, God didn't want all that idolatry in there. He wanted that idolatry out. Do you remember who it is that finally finishes the fight, so to speak? It's David, King David, in the days of King David. And let's put a little time to that now. What timeline are we dealing with right now approximately? B.C., 1500, approximately. Just giving you a rough number, it's around 1500. Does anybody know how many years the judges lasted? The judges lasted about 350 years. Bad time, dark ages, 350 years, dark ages, living with and committing idolatry. in the promised land. Do you remember, again, you got 40 plus years wandering here, so there's just add, say, 400 years. Now we're at King David. About 1000 B.C. is when they finally get up here and get their act straight. 500 years. God gave them the promise a long time. It takes them about 500 years to finally get that promise worked out. Just something to think about. Sometimes when you're reading the Bible and you're doing the daily Bible reading, and you don't think about maybe the timeline. You know, that's important. So just look at this map. We'll probably come back to this map. Remember, I told you that that other map just a moment ago put Elam and Rephidim over here. I'm just showing you that because there's sometimes some contradiction between geographers, I guess. But this is the commonly accepted, and I think this is the right one. All right, just another little color. I didn't know if that would show up. Okay, a little small, but there you go. I kind of now I'm shrinking it down for you is what I was doing. I have to remind myself what I was trying to do. All right, so here again is Goshen. You got Ramses, and this is where they're going to wander, and they're going to come around over here, and then they're finally going to come over there through Jericho and take the promised land. This is a common route up to that area. They do not go that way. They go down and wander around. Just showing you. Okay? There's a picture of Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai. Now, I don't know what bush. I mean, it might have been that bush over there burning. Maybe that one. I don't know. But the bush that was burning was somewhere around Mount Horeb. This may be setting. And this is the this is a picture of Mount Horeb. Just a little artistic rendition of a bush that's burning. And I imagine if you were there, you would probably be pretty amazed. Look at Exodus chapter 3. And just notice again, as you consider this land mass area, Mount Horeb, commonly accepted as the Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai. Look at, I just find this interesting, verse 5, Exodus 3, verse 5. We noticed it in Acts chapter 7. But it says, "And he said, draw not nigh hither, put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God." So through the representation of a burning bush, God represents himself, and he often does that by fire. It's called the Shekinah glory in the Hebrew. But I look at that land, and I don't know what changed in 1500 B.C. to 2000 or 1950 or 40 when this picture was taken. You've got a shepherd down here. You can see him, and I think there's some animals maybe. Maybe I'm wrong on that. But there's some ruins here. This has been, no doubt, there's some kind of structure up in here, and you can look this up. But I look at that land, and I think of holy ground. You're standing on holy ground. Well, I don't know about you, but that doesn't look very holy to me. That looks very dry. But when God's presence is there, it's holy. When we're together as the church, it's holy. God's presence is with us. And we need to remember that. We are the temple of the living God, right? You know, we're not a temple made with hands, man's hands. Our spirits are His, paid and bought for with the blood of Jesus Christ. So just think about some of that as you consider this study. Now, fast forwarding a little bit, or going back, I guess, or to the plagues here in Egypt. Well, of course, at the burning bush, he's told to go talk to Pharaoh, and Aaron will be the spokesman and so forth, and we understand that story. But I want to talk to you about, just for a moment, some passages here that maybe you didn't realize. Look at Exodus 8, verse 22, and we'll talk about the land of Egypt just a little bit more. But notice Goshen, the land where the Israelites were living and had grown. But notice in Exodus 8:22 where it says, "And I will sever in that day the land of Goshen in which my people dwell, that no swarms of flies shall be there, to the end thou mayest know that I am the Lord in the midst of the earth. Look at chapter 9, verses 4 and following. This is the significance of these plagues over the Egyptians. And the Lord shall sever between the cattle of Israel and the cattle of Egypt, and there shall nothing die of all that is the children's of Israel. And then you can read how that takes place. Chapter 10, verse 23. They saw not one another, neither rose any from his place for 3 days, but all the children of Israel had light in their dwelling in the land of Goshen. Chapter 11, verse 7. But against any of the children of Israel shall not a dog move his tongue, against man or beast, that ye may know how the Lord doth put a difference between the Egyptians and Israel. And then chapter 12, verse 13. Notice here. And the blood shall be to you for a token upon the houses where ye are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be upon you to destroy you when I smite the land of Egypt. When I smite the land of Egypt. I want you to realize that here, God, I don't know how much this encompassed of the plagues. I mean, you're talking about Egypt. You're talking about a lot of area. What I know is this. When you get to the book of Joshua, you've got people up in here at Jericho, the harlot, saying, 40 years later, we're afraid of you. And the reason we're afraid of you is because we heard about all that happened. Now, do you stop and think about the fact that that's 40 plus years later? Now, I don't know about you, but 40 years ago, what was that? What generation? What is this? 2017? Was it 1967? No. 77. Wow, you'd be 50 if you were born in 67. Is that right? Is that right? Wow, that's getting close. Okay. So you see what I'm saying? You start thinking about time and you start putting that into common. So what was going on in 1977 in this country? Do we stop and think about it? Who was president? Jimmy Carter? Jimmy Carter, right? Reagan became president in 79, 78, 79, 80. So you see what I'm saying? I'm just pointing out some Bible facts. 40 plus years later, right, we get to Joshua. Maybe you'll consider that. So again, the land of Goshen right here was protected from the plagues. And I'm sure that made those Egyptians, that Pharaoh, pretty aggravated. But what was that supposed to do? What were the plagues supposed to do? Look at Exodus 12, verse 12. What was the plagues? What were they against when you look at Exodus 12, verse 12? What does the Bible say? Each one of those plagues represented something. That's right. Somebody read chapter 12, verse 12, just to read that passage out loud. From what I understand, and I'm no Egyptianologist, but I don't have any reason to deny it. That passage there says that God is judging the gods of Egypt. And turning the river Nile red was a mocking a god, goddess, that they considered that river to represent. And that river, by the way, was represented by a female in the feminine goddess because it was a river of life. And what's the river, what's the representation of life? Where are babies born and so forth? From the women. So the god was a feminine god and it was a smiting or a mocking, if you will, to the goddess of the river Nile when they turned that river red. God was showing his power. Now, the fly, same thing. Flies represented a god. Frogs represent a god. You can still see frogs represented in their hieroglyphics. Those things were representation of gods. It's speculative that when they were told to throw the Hebrew baby boys into the River Nile to sacrifice them or to kill them, how would you justify that if you're an Egyptian or a Pharaoh? You can justify that if you're a pagan. If you're a pagan and you believe this is a worthy cause to sacrifice to your goddess, and we're going to throw these babies, here's our Thanksgiving offering, and we're going to kill babies. Now that's just an observation. That's not said in the Bible, and I taught that in a Bible class because I believe that's likely justification of the pagan mindset. Okay? How do you justify taking live human beings up down in the Incans and the Mayans down in South America and take living people and sacrifice them up on top of those temples and find those encrusted tombs and those no doubt young children and stuff that were sacrificed? How do you justify that? The only way you can justify that as not murder is to be a pagan offering human sacrifice. That's not uncommon. Even the children of Israel will offer what to the god of Molech? Eventually getting caught up in idolatry. That's right. Point being, we don't realize in this country how far removed we still are from that type of mindset. We have a lot of problems. And perhaps abortion is the idolatry that we underestimate. I don't think we underestimate it, though. I think we know exactly what's going on. But anyway, here again, you have some various routes and so forth. I am not going to show pictures of the Red Sea and the crossing and the so-called dramatic effects, because do we really know where and when and how much this water mass may have changed over time? I don't know. You've got some people looking for chariot wheels, and you've got looking for a lot of things, Pharaoh's army, all over the place. They got them looking over here at the Gulf of Aqaba. And you've got various speculators saying it was right here. No, it was right here. No, it was right over here. And we don't know. But what we do know is what the Bible says. And when we get to that part, when they step on that what was wet water, the Bible says they step on muddy? No, dry. And what does it say about the water? Walls of water. So that'd be pretty neat, wouldn't it? People have tried to explain that away and say, well, nature can do this, man. A big wind can come up and God could have stood by that. But I don't know that nature can take that ground and turn it dry immediately. You see what I'm saying? That's a miracle. That's a miracle that defies nature. So anyway, you've got a lot of different just things to consider here, caravan routes and so forth that would take place. There's a lot of things. Travel was not uncommon, and they were trying to get out of there. I know my time's about up, so I'm winding it up here right now. Here's again a fast forward to when they will get out. We're going to talk about the waters at Marah. Remember Marah? Bitter. And I'm going to talk about the springs of Elam. They'll end up at the springs of Elam. But here again shows you another little route to consider. Quail and Manna somewhere around in this area. 12 spies over here. Jericho there. Mount Sinai right here. Remember, 50 miles, you know, I'm saying approximately 250 if you're... That's just a guesstimate on my part. Any comments or questions on some of this? Well, I hope that, again, what we've said or some of what we said is informative, helps you kind of think a little bit. But we'll pick back up on that divided sea. I just don't think we're going to have time to get into that. And I want to talk about baptism a little bit and talk about Moses' leadership a little bit more. So I'm still in Exodus. Not making too much progress. Okay? Well, we'll stop a little bit early. Thank you for your attention.